Good afternoon and welcome to Speaking in Maine here on MPBN Radio. I'm Lindsay Maynard. Today we will take you to Portland for an address by former U.S. Senator George Mitchell. In addition to being a U.S. Senator for 15 years, he was the Special Envoy for Northern Ireland under former President Bill Clinton and was most recently the Special Envoy for Middle East Peace under President Barack Obama. He recently spoke at the monthly meeting of the Portland Community Chamber's Eggs and Issues series. This program was pre-recorded for broadcast at this time. This program will be archived on our website, mpbn.net. Click on Audio on Demand to hear the program again at your convenience or to access many other past Speaking in Maine programs. This program will also be available as a podcast. Introducing our speaker today is Michael Bork, President of the Portland Community Chamber.
Good morning. Good morning and welcome to Eggs and Issues, the eggs-free edition of Eggs and Issues today. We're the monthly business forum of the Portland Community Chamber, and I really thank you all for joining us here today at historic Portland High School. As you all know, founded in 1821, it is the second oldest continuously operating school in the country. I understand Portland High School has 1,000 students. They speak, they come from 41 different countries, and they can text, tweet, and speak 26 different languages. My name is Michael Bork. I'm a senior vice president at MEMC, and I am the volunteer president of the Portland Community Chamber. As you all know, of course, our special guest here today is the Honorable United States Senator George Mitchell. Well, why are we here today? Why are we here at Portland High School? Our normal venue for Eggs and Issues was unavailable to us, and we're delighted that we could be here at Portland High School. This is a great opportunity for many members of the business community to come in and see the school and to get to meet some students, I hope. So we thank the school for hosting us. Before I move on to Senator Mitchell's remarks, I want to also offer thanks to our annual sponsors of the program. This program is made possible by their generous support, and all of them are leaders here in our business community. Please hold your applause until I announce all of them. Our presenting sponsors, Martins Point Healthcare, Bank of America, and Wright Express. Our cooperating sponsors, Unum and IDEX. Our reception sponsors, Oxford Networks and Clark Insurance. Thanks as well to Baker Newman & Noyes for sponsoring our Community Corner program. Overall production support of Eggs and Issues is provided by Headlight Audiovisual, and our program is broadcast by Time Warner Cable each month. This month, in November, Eggs and Issues is aired on Mondays at 8 a.m. on Cable Channel 9. Also today, a special thanks to Maine Public Radio, which is taping our program for rebroadcast on its Speaking in Maine program. Our media sponsor is The Forecaster. Our e-media partner is Maine Biz. We also thank special community partners of the Chamber, Anthem Blue Cross and Blue Shield, Northeast Delta Dental, the Portland Press Herald, Maine Sunday Telegram, and PressHerald.com. Please join me now in thanking all of our sponsors. Okay, now on to our featured speaker. A reminder that when Senator Mitchell finishes, we will have a question and answer session. For that portion of the event, please come to microphones. Do we have microphones available? We do. Microphones will be available in the aisle. Please identify yourself and any organization you're associated with and ask your question. Of course, all of us here today are familiar with Senator George Mitchell's distinguished career in public service, but let me just offer a few highlights. He was appointed to the United States Senate in 1980 to complete the unexpired term of Senator Edmund Muskie, who had resigned to become Secretary of State under President Carter. Senator Mitchell was then elected to a full term in the Senate in 1982 and went on to an illustrious career spanning 15 years. He left the Senate in 1995 as the majority leader. Senator Mitchell enjoyed bipartisan respect during his tenure. For six consecutive years, he was voted the most respected member of the Senate by a bipartisan group of senior congressional aides. While in the Senate, Senator Mitchell served on the Finance, Veterans Affairs, and Environment and Public Works committees. He led the successful 1990 reauthorization of the Clean Air Act and was author of the first national oil spill prevention and cleanup law. Senator Mitchell led the Senate to passage of the nation's first child care bill and was principal author of the low-income housing tax credit program. He was instrumental in the passage of the Americans with Disabilities Act and led the passage of a higher education bill that expanded opportunities for millions of Americans. Of course, we know he retired from the Senate. And after that, I think, Senator, you went to the west coast of Florida and enjoyed early bird specials for the rest of the last 15 years. You know, he could easily have done that and still would have had an illustrious career. But we all know what's happened since, and that's been truly remarkable as well. In 1995, he served as special advisor to President Clinton on Ireland. And from 1996 to 2000, he served famously as the independent chairman of the Northern Ireland peace talks, ending the troubles that plagued that part of the world for so long. In 2000 and 2001, the senator served as chairman of the International Fact-Finding Committee on Violence in the Middle East. From January 2009 to May 2011, he served as U.S. Special Envoy for Middle East Peace. He also, of course, created and continues to provide leadership to the Mitchell Institute, which has, among other things, awarded $8 million in scholarships to more than 1,800 Maine students. The senator was named one of Time Magazine's 100 Most Influential Persons in the World in 2008. He is, of course, a Maine native. Senator Mitchell received an undergraduate degree from Bowdoin College and a law degree from Georgetown University Law Center. It is the Chamber's great privilege to once again say welcome home to Senator George Mitchell and to welcome him back to Eggs and Issues.
Thanks very much, Michael, for that generous introduction. Thank you, ladies and gentlemen, for your warm reception. I appreciate the invitation and opportunity to participate again in the Eggs and Issues program. It's been a real pleasure for me to have been able to spend the last several days traveling around Maine, attending various events. It reminds me of my days in the Senate, where I learned and always kept in mind that Maine people are very independent, also that they generally have a very good sense of humor. And so I'd like to begin by telling a couple of stories that illustrate these Maine qualities and then get on to discuss the serious subjects of the day. When I entered the Senate, as Michael indicated, by appointment, one of the first things I did was to acquaint myself with not only the general issues of the day, but specific problems that were faced in parts of Maine and see what I could do to help with them. And one of them involved Acadia National Park, where a very nice a restaurant in the park called the Jordan Pond House, I'm sure many of you have been there, had burned down, and a fundraising drive had fallen short of getting the money to rebuild it. And so I was able to secure funding from the Department of Interior, which operates the park system, to complete the building. And after it was finished, I went back one summer with a friend to have a meal there. And while we were waiting in line, we decided to call another friend of ours to ask him to join us from Bangor. And we went to where there had been a payphone. You don't see many payphones these days, but there was a pay telephone there, and there was a line, about four or five people in line, and the guy at the payphone had put up a card with several numbers, so he was obviously making a series of calls, and he was plugging quarters into this machine and banging it and swearing quite loudly, and so we were about fifth in line waiting as this went on, and then another guy came behind, and then after a while there were about 10 people in line. And the fellow behind me tapped me on the shoulder. He said, "Excuse me, are you Senator Mitchell?" I said, "Yes, I am." He said, "What are you doing here?" I said, "I'm on vacation." So I did the normal thing. I said, "What's your name?" He said, "My name's Bob McGillicuddy." I said, "Where are you from?" He said, "Bangor." I said, "Are you here on vacation?" He said, "No, I'm working." I said, "What do you do?" He said, "I'm a telephone repairman." And there was a few seconds while I digested what he said. And he said, "I'm waiting in line, and when my turn comes, I'm going to fix that phone." And then he leaned forward and he whispered to me in a conspiratorial tone of voice. He said, "Senator," he said, "if I were you, I'd go downstairs. There's a phone down there, and I know it works because I just fixed it." There's another story that reminds me about Maine people and how they speak their mind. When I first started out, I was one day campaigning in a rural area in central Maine, going door to door. Now, you know, when politicians go door to door, they only see a very few people during the day, so you try to get a television cameraman or a newspaper man to follow you, so they'll record it, and other people will see that you're going door to door. So I had the local newspaper traveling with me, and I stopped at one farmhouse, and a guy was very polite, invited me in, and he wanted to show me his two prize cows. And we went out back, and he told me the story that he had a very good set of dairy cows, and he had been visited by an emissary of the government of Saudi Arabia, which wanted to improve their dairy herd, and so they bought two of his prize cows, and he's very proud of them, and he asked me if I would have my picture taken with his cows. You know, the art of politics is the ability to make a fool of yourself gracefully. So I went and had my picture taken with two cows, first time and only time it had ever happened. And the next day, the picture appeared in a local newspaper. And I continued traveling in the area, and I went to another farmhouse a few miles away, and an elderly gentleman answered the door, and I put out my hand and introduced myself. He said, "Oh, I know who you are." I said, "Well, how do you know that?" He said, "I seen your picture in the paper with them two cows." And I said, "What'd you think about it?" And he looked me right in the eye. He said, "Senator, I'm a Republican. I think we should keep the cows here and send you to Saudi Arabia." One more story. Michael indicated, I entered the Senate by appointment. I was serving as a federal judge here in Portland and in Bangor, had been appointed as a federal judge for just a year before, and Senator Muskie was appointed Secretary of State, and Governor Brennan announced that he was going to promptly act to name a successor. And said he would hold a press conference at the state capitol in a few days to announce his choice. There are a few of you here old enough to remember that there was a lot of speculation. We had a former governor, a former senator, a former congressman, all of whom were very well qualified, whose names were mentioned in the press, and my name was not. And so on the night before the scheduled announcement, I went to bed like everybody else in Maine, wondering what the governor was going to do the next day. About 11 o'clock that night, the phone rang. It was the governor on the phone asking me to come to Augusta, to the state capitol, where he was wanted to announce that he was going to appoint me to the Senate. I said, "Gee, Governor, this is a very difficult decision. I need time to think about this. I got to talk to members of my family. I've got to call some friends." He said, "I'll give you 1 hour." When I protested, he said, "That's it. You got to call me by midnight. Tell me one way or the other." So I immediately picked up the phone and I called my three older brothers. I grew up in Waterville, and my three older brothers were very well known, not just in Waterville, but in central Maine and around the whole state, because they were great athletes, particularly in basketball. And then I came along, and I was not as good as my brothers. In fact, I was not as good as anybody else's brother. And so at a very early age in life in Waterville, I became known as Johnny Mitchell's kid brother, the one who isn't any good. As you might expect, I developed a massive inferiority complex and a highly competitive attitude toward my brothers. And that continued to this day, but that evening, after hanging up from talking to the governor, when I called my brothers ostensibly to seek their advice, I confess there was a note of triumphalism in my voice. I said to them, "The governor wants to appoint me to the Senate. What do you guys think about that?" The responses were predictably negative. My brother Johnny said, look, everybody knows you're a born loser. You couldn't possibly win a statewide election. He said, we can't understand how you got to be a federal judge in the first place, but you better stay there. My oldest brother, who is somewhat more level-headed, sought to raise the quality of the discussion. He said, well, let's just look at this from the standpoint of the people of Maine. They're entitled to have a qualified person representing them in the Senate. And he said, you obviously are not one of them. So you should let the governor appoint someone who could do this job. Well, I hung up the phone, I called the governor, and I said, Governor, I don't need an hour. I've already received all the reassurance I need of my ability to serve in this job. And I went down and did it, and I enjoyed it very much. And as Michael indicated, after serving in the Senate, I started a scholarship fund because I became convinced of the importance of education, not just to the individuals who get the education, but to our society as a whole. And I begin my discussion of education by talking about a slightly different subject, and that is immigration. When I served as a federal judge, I had great power. In fact, it's the only job I've ever had in which I had any real power. And I really enjoyed that part of the job. But what I most enjoyed was when I presided over what are called naturalization ceremonies. They're citizenship ceremonies. A group of people who'd gone through all of the required procedures, who came from every part of the world, gathered before me in a federal courtroom just a few feet away here in Portland or in Bangor. And by the power vested in me under our Constitution, I administered to them the oath of allegiance to the United States, and I made them Americans. It was always a very emotional ceremony for me, and after each one, I made it a point to speak personally with each of the new Americans, individually or in family groups. Their stories were inspiring. We're all, most of us, are Americans by an accident of birth. All of them are Americans by an act of free will, often at great risk to themselves and their families. And although their stories were as different as their countries of origin, there were some common themes. They were best summarized by a young Asian man who, when I asked why he came, said in very slow and halting English, I came because here in America, everybody has a chance. Think about the fact that a young man who had been an American for less than 10 minutes, who could barely speak English, was able to sum up the meaning of our country in a single sentence. America is freedom and opportunity. And I believe that there are many reasons for our success as a society, an important one being education. And so I want to begin by talking about how I came to get an education, the role that others played in my life, and then I want to get into a broader discussion of the subject itself. My mother was an immigrant from Lebanon. She could not read or write English. My father was the orphan son of Irish immigrants who never knew his parents, left school after the fourth grade, and worked as a janitor at a local school. They knew the hard life of those who lacked learning. They wanted something different for their children, so their central goal in life was that their children could receive the education they never had. They had a profound, even an exaggerated belief in the value of education. My brothers preceded me to college, two on basketball scholarships, one in a naval officer's training program. But in my senior year in high school, my father lost his job. And for a full year, with declining self-esteem and growing despair, he looked in vain for work. Fortunately, my mother continued to work. She was a worker in a textile mill on the night shift. That kept us going, but it was a tense and difficult year in which, understandably, there was no talk of my going to college. One day that spring, My father told me that his former boss, a man in Waterville named Hervey Fogg, had called and asked if I would go to see him. My father didn't know what it was about, neither did I, but he said it would be impolite to decline, and he urged me to go, so I went to see Mr. Fogg, who I had never met, and it soon became clear that all he wanted to do was to help me. He told me that he had gone to Bowdoin. He encouraged me to consider it, and in fact, he said he'd already set up an appointment for me with the director of admissions the next week. A week later, I set off to travel from Waterville to Brunswick. I was 16 years old, uncertain, insecure, with a massive inferiority complex. I had traveled little outside of Waterville. I'd never been on a train or a plane. My parents didn't own a car. So I got up very early in the morning, walked to the outskirts of Waterville, and hitchhiked to Brunswick. Within minutes, I got a ride, and the driver took me directly to the campus. Since I was several hours early for the appointment, I spent 5 hours walking around and memorizing the name and location of every building on the campus, so I never did get lost later while I was at Bowdoin. And then I met the director of admissions there. He was a man named Bill Shaw. I was very nervous, felt out of place. He was very kind and thoughtful. When I told him that my parents could afford nothing to pay for tuition, he was reassuring. He said, well, you've been a good student, and if you're willing to work, we'll figure something out. And he did. He helped arrange several part-time jobs for me, and I was able to get through college working pretty much full-time in a variety of different jobs. And many others helped me at Bowdoin along the way. One of the jobs I had was driving a truck for the Brunswick Oil and Lumber Company, owned by the Morrow family there, which still operates in Brunswick. I'd just gotten my driver's license. I'd only driven a car twice, and I had never driven a truck. So I can still recall the terrifying experience of driving a large flatbed truck up Route 1 to Thomaston, to load it up with 90-pound bags of cement and drive back down Route 1. Anybody who thinks the current bridge at Wiscasset is a problem should have seen the old wooden bridge that existed at that time. It really was a problem. But I'll always be grateful to men like Hervey Fogg and Bill Shaw and the Morrow family who didn't know me but who wanted only to help me because they saw in me something that I myself didn't know existed. Now, it's obvious that neither I nor anyone else could replicate this experience today. Tuition costs were relatively low then. Jobs were plentiful. Costs have risen so much, jobs have become so scarce, that no young person today could do what I was lucky enough to do. And as a result, financial assistance has become crucial to higher education today. Why was a Bowdoin education important to me? Why will higher education be critical to those who live in the 21st century? Because increasingly, success in human affairs will be based on knowledge. Learning is desirable and rewarding for its own sake, but in the future, it will be much more. It will be essential to success, however success is defined: health, happiness, status, wealth, service to others. There are, of course, in our nation's history, many men and women who succeeded in life without an education, and they were an important and heartwarming part of our nation's history. But they will be very rare in the next century and beyond. Americans don't lack for information. There's more of it available than ever before. Just a few years ago, there were just 3 television networks and a few independent stations. Now, almost every home has access to hundreds, some even thousands, of television channels. Where once Americans read a handful of mass market magazines, today there are hundreds of small niche magazines which cater to every taste and every preference. The dissecting of the national audience is a result of the interplay of technology and free markets, and they provide enormous benefits. They give each American a far wider range of information and entertainment from which to choose. It makes possible the satisfaction of more individual interests, reflecting and catering to the enormous diversity in American life. But it comes at a price of fewer and fewer shared national values and experiences. The technology which gives us choice of information and entertainment also shreds the national audience for news and information. Except for a few spectacular events, we're in danger of becoming a society of diverse groups rather than a nation of people with shared experience and values. The United States is not a nation only when a hurricane or a bombing or a sensational trial occurs. The harder tasks of nationhood are done every day by millions of ordinary citizens in their jobs, their schools, and their communities. A society and a culture, especially our own, which did not have the intense close bonds of family, clan, ethnic, and religious identity, but rather is a conglomeration of many. A society like ours is held together by the slow and steady labor of ordinary citizens, which establish values and build communities. But American democracy, like all democracies, depends upon informed and rational public debate for successful operation and for its ultimate survival. All of us need critical reasoning skills to distinguish falsehood from truth, fiction from reality, fantasy from fact. And that's especially true in light of the reality that the human brain is so structured and we live in a manner in which we are very open and receptive to information and facts which conform to the views which we previously held and very resistant to information and facts which contradict views we previously held. If you had a diagram that would show it, the receptors for information which agree with us are this big, and for those with which disagree with us are this big. And that's the basis on which much of the news market is created today by purveyors of information who cater to those who agree with their view. And you see a divergence of news into discrete units catering to specific people who happen to agree. Now, it's only through critical thought, through logical reasoning, through careful definition and open debate that we as citizens can hope to see past the blur of information to the realities on which our public choices should, in fact, be made. And that is precisely reasoning and skill that are the most important contributions of a higher education. They provide the critical lubricant of a successful, particularly democratic society. And never in our history have they been more necessary than they are today. The ability to reason, to think clearly, to examine old assumptions, to rebut misleading argument is an essential counterweight to the massive assault of information and misinformation with which each of us is bombarded every day. Higher education is the only institution in our society which has as its central purpose the continued reexamination of our society's assumptions. Universal truths are universal truths until they become disbelieved in society. And there are many, many examples in our history of what seemed to be a certainty, proving ultimately to be not so certain. From the beginning of our society, Americans placed their hopes for the future in education. Thomas Jefferson famously said, "If a nation expects to be ignorant and free, it expects what never was and never will be." Our colonial fathers built public schools. Even in the midst of the Civil War, the first Republican administration in American history and a heavily Republican Congress authorized land-grant colleges to spread the benefit of education throughout an expanding nation. And all of the state university systems today derive from that landmark and very important legislation. At the end of the Second World War, Congress passed the GI Bill, which for the first time provided federal assistance directly to individuals seeking higher education. When that law was passed, only 4% of Americans had a college degree. Today, it's well over 25%. Is there anybody who thinks that was a bad idea? I don't think so. And beyond the national interest is the importance of creating opportunity for every member of society, central to our society's beliefs and to its success. We all know that more education means more income for the individual, and several recent studies confirm that belief, as well as a number of other beliefs that are relevant to the debate. For example, today, the earnings of Maine workers with a bachelor's degree are more than 50% higher than for those with only a high school diploma, and much higher than that for those who don't even have a high school diploma. And the unemployment rate for those with a bachelor's degree is 50% lower than for those with only a high school diploma. Even in these very tough times, the unemployment rate among Maine workers with a bachelor's degree is just under 3%. Demand for college-educated workers in Maine is projected to grow about 7 times faster than for high school graduates. The Georgetown Center on Education and the Workforce estimates that by 2018, there will be 396,000 jobs in Maine for workers with post-secondary education, compared with only 242,000 workers with no education beyond high school. That, of course, will be a complete reversal of the historic trend, and the gap will continue to grow. And in financial terms, all across the United States, for every four-year degree earned, for each person who gets a four-year degree, total tax revenue to federal, state, and local governments increase over that person's lifetime by $471,000. And total government spending decreases. So, simply put, investment in education pays off for the individual and for society. All this and more led me to create a scholarship program for Maine students when I left the Senate. I had received much help, and I wanted others similarly situated to receive help. And I also wanted them to have the same expectation I had for hard work, for the belief that work in and of itself is a value and it induces discipline which enables one to succeed in every part of life. As Michael indicated, our scholarship program has so far provided $8 million in financial assistance to over 1,800 students, and both numbers rise each year as we give out one scholarship to a graduate from each of Maine's 130 public high schools. And our scholars do great things in college and in their communities. They work hard. Over 90% earn all A's and B's in college. We have one of the highest graduation rates, nearly 95%, of any scholarship program in the country. And they do give back, this past year, more than 30,000 hours of community service here in Maine. Nearly 70% of our graduates currently live and work in Maine, and fully 90% plan to do so within the next 5 years. I've often been asked many questions, most often what principles guided my actions in public office. They're few and they're simple. Foremost among them is my conviction that in America, no one should be guaranteed success, but everyone should have a fair chance to succeed. For me, education made that possible. Shouldn't every American have the same chance? Thank you very much for having me. Thank you for your attention. And thank you. Thank you. Thank you. And I'll be glad now to take your questions or comments, or if anybody would like to make a speech, I'll be glad to listen to that. I think we have microphones here and throughout the audience. If nobody has a question, I'll tell a couple more stories, and then we can... there's one right here.
Senator, thank you. Could you comment on the current state of 9% approval rating of Congress and the prospects of the super committee and sort of where we are today and how it's changed since you were the leader?
Right. Congress has the lowest approval rating since such ratings were generated of 9%. But we ought to put it in context that never in American history has Congress been popular. One of the most decisive elections in the early nation's history was in 1814, when Congress first voted to increase its pay, and three-fourths of the members of the House were defeated in the next election. There is a tendency on the part of all of us to look to the past with rose-colored glasses. It always seems better than it really was, and to look to the future with blinders. It always seems worse than it's going to be. It is worse now than it's ever been. I acknowledge that. But it's never been great. There was never a moment in American history when we were free of partisanship, free of bickering, free of personal attacks. You only have to go back to the Jeffersonian era and to read the history of the things that were said about Jefferson. And I've often wondered, I took my son to Gettysburg last year where we had a really moving and inspirational day, and I wondered at the time whether Lincoln, with his rather unattractive features and his whiny, high-pitched voice, could have survived if there'd been cable news networks in 1864 when he ran for re-election. And, of course, in modern history, everyone knows about the very strong attacks on Franklin Roosevelt during his tenure. So there's nothing new. It is a little bit worse, a lot worse now, I'll say that. When I was Senate Majority Leader for 6 years, Bob Dole was the Republican leader. And after I was elected, the first person I went to see was Senator Dole. I said to him that these are very tough jobs, I think impossible in bad circumstances and just barely tolerable in good circumstances. And I suggested a set of simple rules of behavior in which we would inform each other in advance of our actions, not try to embarrass each other, not make any personal attacks. He readily and enthusiastically embraced it, and to this day, not ever in private or public has a harsh word passed between us. We were and are very close personal friends. So it's possible to conduct business in a way that doesn't have personal attacks, even though there is disagreement. I'm not optimistic about this changing until the American people decide that it ought to change. The essence of democracy is the people. The very word is a combination of two Greek words, demos, the people, kratzi, the ruler. The word democracy means the rule of the people. And as long as they tolerate the current situation, even though they complain about it, I think it will continue. There are a number of factors, and they're certainly not exhaustive, and I don't claim to be an expert on such subjects, but if you look at it, we've had very partisan redistricting of congressional seats in recent years. The result has been that in the House of Representatives, only a small percentage of the total number of seats up for election every 2 years are truly competitive. They've been gerrymandered in a way that there are solidly Democratic and solidly Republican seats, and very few of them have to compete for the middle, and as a result, the extremes in both parties tend to play a disproportionate role, although they are a relatively small portion of the total electorate. We have famously low levels of participation in our country, about 50% of eligible voters actually vote in presidential elections, about a third vote in midterm congressional elections, and a very small fraction vote in primary elections. And yet increasingly, because of the redistricting, the decisive moment is not the general election, but it's the primary election, and so that gives a hugely disproportionate weight to the extremes in both parties who do tend to be active in primary elections. The second is the influx of money. I personally have a very strong disagreement with the Supreme Court decision of a couple of years ago that has essentially opened the floodgates to money. I think it's a corrupting, there is a corrupting consequence of it. Not so much in the number of individuals who are corrupt, because they are relatively few in our society, although they do exist, but rather in the sense that the public comes to view elected officials as being primarily responsive to contributors and not to voters, which corrupts and reduces their trust in Congress as reflected by the 9% figure. I think it's going to take, as so often occurs in our history, some major scandal to arouse public opinion and demand and force a change. That's a routine pattern in our country's history. People don't get excited until something really bad happens, and then they change things. And I hope, I don't hope for a scandal, but I hope the change will come. Thank you. Go ahead.
Hello. I'm a junior at Portland High. My name's Chip Weber. I was just wondering if you could comment on the your time as the envoy to the Middle East, and with evidence like the Arab Spring, why do you think like your mission for peace in the Middle East ultimately failed?
Yeah. Michael said a lot of nice things about me in the introduction, and that usually always happens in introductions. My wife was less kind. She provides balance to my life, and when I return from my 2 years in the Middle East, she said, well, welcome back. The expectations for you were zero, and you met them. The subject is extremely complex, deeply rooted in history and involving highly emotional issues such as religion, national identity, territorial competition. So I cannot do it full justice in what I'll try to make a relatively brief response. So please understand that this can be nothing more than a general overview. It is difficult to be optimistic in the short term. The parties now have a very high level of mistrust and hostility, and despite the best efforts of the United States and our allies, we've not been able to get them to resume and remain in negotiations to try to reach an agreement. But I believe that in the more medium term, and I don't mean decades, I mean in the relatively near future, it is possible, and I hope very much, that they will return to negotiations and reach an agreement. And I believe that it's possible because, in my judgment, the pain that they will endure to reach an agreement, which will be substantial, is nonetheless much smaller, much less than the pain they will endure if they don't reach an agreement. There is a lull now which has created a false sense of security. But the reality is that if they do not reach an agreement to end the conflict, both Israel and the Palestinian Authority face a very dangerous and a very harsh future. And let me identify some, I can't do all, of the challenges they face. First, understand that what Israel has is a successful state, a highly successful state. Those of you who've been to Israel will know what I'm talking about. Those of you who have not, I would urge you to go if you ever get the chance. It is moving. It is very powerful. They have been extremely successful, for which they deserve great credit. But they don't have security for their people. They live in fear and anxiety, and they ought to have security. The Palestinians, on the other hand, don't have a state, and they have the right to a state. They have the same right of self-determination which Americans demanded for themselves in our Declaration of Independence, and which 194 other peoples now have around the world. with all of the self-esteem and other benefits that come from self-governance. I believe that neither can attain its objective by denying to the other side its objective. Stated another way, I don't think the Palestinians are ever going to get a state until the people of Israel have a reasonable and sustainable sense of security. But I don't think the Israelis can get that until the Palestinians get a state. So they should be mutually vested in each other's objective. So far, they're not. But if they don't do it, then here's what they face, possibly, for Israel. At this moment, there are 5.75 million Jews living in the area between the Jordan River and the Mediterranean Sea. In the same area, there are 5.25 million Arabs, Israeli Arabs, Palestinians in the West Bank, and in Gaza. The birth rate among Palestinians is much, much higher overall. And every demographer with whom we consulted confirmed that within a relatively short time, the number of Arabs will exceed the number of Jews. And if the two-state solution has been lost, that means the people of Israel will confront the awful choice of choosing between having a Jewish state or a democratic state. They will not be able to have both once a two-state solution is lost. This is a matter of widespread public debate in Israel. The former prime minister and now defense minister, Ehud Barak, has discussed it publicly. He has said, and I share his view, they must act before they confront that choice. And that's a matter of just a few years. Secondly, what is the threat to Israel's existence? Historically, it has been major land armies, national wars across national borders, tanks, planes. That's not the threat now. The threat is rockets. Hamas has 6,000 to 8,000 of them on Israel's southern border, crude, homemade, relatively ineffective. On Israel's northern border, Hezbollah has 30,000 of them, limited in range, but somewhat more effective than the Hamas, and Hezbollah's engaged in a massive upgrade of their systems. Most dangerously, Iran now possesses rockets, which can reach Israel. They don't yet have precise military accuracy. They can't pinpoint a specific object, but they can devastate major cities. And that's the real threat. One reason why the United States, which has provided massive financial assistance to Israel over the course of its existence, has increased our assistance to help them develop an anti-missile system. But no one knows for sure whether that or any other anti-missile system would be effective in the event that very large numbers of rockets were launched in an all-out conflict. That's the real threat. And the third is isolation. Although Israel's support in the United States is strong and growing, particularly in the Congress and in the House of Representatives especially, it's declining everywhere else, as the votes in the United Nations in this year and pending on issues have shown. Huge margins favoring the Palestinians, and that increases Israel's isolation to a degree that is dangerous to its future. Israel once had very good relations with the two major powers in the region, Turkey and Egypt. The relationship with Turkey has badly deteriorated. That with Egypt is in danger of deteriorating. And so they have those concerns. On the other hand, the Palestinians face a bleak future. For 60 years, they've lived under an occupation. If they don't reach an agreement, it could be another 60 years. There is always the possibility of renewed violence, which has been very damaging to both and especially devastating to the Palestinians. In 1948, the United Nations proposed a partition of the area under which the Palestinians would have gotten 45% of the territory and Jerusalem would have become an international city. Israel accepted, the Palestinians rejected it. The Arabs rejected it. There were no Palestinian state then. The Arabs all rejected it. The next day a war began, the first of many which an increasingly strong Israel has won. Every Arab leader today would gladly welcome that proposal, which they rejected 60 years ago, if it were still on the table. But it is not, and it never again will be, because the circumstances have changed so dramatically. And each of the offers made to the Palestinians in the intervening years has been less attractive than the first. I said to both Chairman Arafat when he was head of the Palestinian Authority and directly to President Abbas, their current leader, there is not a shred of evidence, none, to support the conclusion that the offers are going to get better in the future. So they've got to do what practical, pragmatic people do the world over, in business, in government, in their personal affairs. They've got to sit down and negotiate and get the best deal they can. Less than 100%, unfair from their perspective, but get a state and build on it. They can do it. They've demonstrated that ability recently. They have an outstanding prime minister, Fayyad, who's done a remarkable job of establishing law and order, establishing the basis for the viable institutions needed for a successful state, but they've got to get a deal. And they can only get it through negotiation, and so far they've declined to negotiate, and they've got to get in with American help, reach an agreement, and settle the issues, which can be resolved, tough as it is politically. Both societies are divided politically, so it's very hard. It can be done, and I believe it will be done. And I have a strong personal reason, in addition to my having spent many years in the area and made much effort, I want to be able to go to my wife and say, "You spoke too soon." Is that it, Michael, or one more? I can't tell what the signal is. That's it. Thank you all very much. Pleasure to be here.
You've been listening to Speaking in Maine here on NPBN. Today's speaker was former U.S. Senator and diplomat George Mitchell. Mitchell is known for his work on the Arab and Palestinian relations and the conflicts in Northern Ireland. He recently spoke at the monthly meeting of the Portland Community Chamber's Eggs and Issues series. You can listen to this program again at your convenience by accessing it on our website, mpbn.net. Click on Audio on Demand or Podcast to access this program, as well as many other archived Speaking in Maine programs. If you'd like to purchase a taped copy of today's Speaking in Maine, please call MPBN's Audience Services Department at 1-800-884-1717. Again, for a copy of today's Speaking in Maine with former U.S. Senator George Mitchell, the number to call is 1-800-884-1717. Charles Beck is the executive producer of this series. For Speaking in Maine, I'm Lindsay Maynard.